Chapter 25. Geffen's Brilliant Fucking Plan. I never found out what happened to the wagon, but it must have been sold off by the master of Ambrosius's house. I don't know what happened with the money either. The sum had been a fortune beyond all imagination, and yet I have to believe it a pittance compared against the Lord's wealth. Probably one of the guards who took us back to the keep stole it. I'll never learn the answer, I suppose. And yet that seems easier to live with. The hard thing to live with is that I wonder even now if Ambrosius was telling the truth about my donkeys. I've thought about it often. He seemed the kind of man sick enough to do what he claimed, but I wonder. It's a terrible waste, grinding up three perfectly good working animals like that. And even if he was a lord, it's hard for me to imagine someone squandering potential so needlessly. It keeps me awake at night. This trying to imagine what Ambrosius might have done. Sometimes I used to drink myself incoherent, hoping I could convince myself they were just sold off to a farmer somewhere, and that they're out there still, farting away, wasting daylight laying around in their pens. I'd try to imagine every aspect of what their days must be like now, thinking drunkenly that if I could just picture things clearly enough. Well, I thought maybe I could imagine the things I wanted into reality. The only problem was when I became so drunk I couldn't see them clearly enough. I always felt like an idiot after sobering up. But when enough time had gone by that I forgot how embarrassed I was, I would finally come back to the old fantasy. I'd find the fantasy always buried at the pit of a tankard or a bottle. And when I found it, the fantasy was good enough to have. It wasn't enough to have, but it was goddamned good enough. I'm told by the ship that some of Ambrosius's material has been archived somewhere, though what that material is or how it might have been archived, I have no idea. But I'm told the material is sufficient for a rebirth, which at first sounded very good. I might have been taught, though, that the memories of the antecedent are lost forever, and so the reborn would not truly be my Ambrosius. And so he shall remain in ship's archives. I'm told what we have is enough to recreate him with such faith that even the ship couldn't tell, and I cannot. The memories are gone. The memories are gone, and only I remain. We traded my comfortable, spacious wagon for a rolling cage that was either purposely built for Reese's size or something they'd had lying around that was typically used for the transportation of enormous animals, perhaps a bear. I think it must have been the latter. The iron-banded wood of the bars was very dark and seemed old. In some places, whole spans of wood had been worried away until only the rusted iron remained. I wondered if one of those bands would rust away enough for Risa to break it. Ultimately, none did. The first day in the cage was difficult. Risa's legs took up most of the floor space. The guards forced us into the pen by jabbing spear points into our asses, so we didn't have any time to arrange ourselves for comfort until the wagon was halfway out of Goslar. Even then, it was hard to get comfortable. The people on the streets would sometimes pelt us with scraps of garbage or rocks. It wasn't so often as to be a constant barrage, and yet if you ever relaxed enough to settle into a corner, that was surely when the next rock struck you. We didn't really find an arrangement that worked until we'd passed beyond the city gates. Then it was just Risa trying to position his limbs so they would not fall asleep, and I trying to occupy only the space that he left vacant. It worked out better for me than him. And then, after a while, we became used to it. Five of them traveled with us. They were all uniformed and rather large. Well, large for me anyway. I didn't know how they would have measured up against Risa, not at the time. So I told him to behave when they couldn't hear. He did. Yet I can't think of any point during our travel where he could have gotten over on them. We were allowed out of the cage twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening, to shit. We were expected to piss through the bars, which we did after suffering long enough. I guess scrubbing prisoner shit from the cart was more than the guards were willing to do. There was a neck iron connecting each of us to the ceiling of the cage. These could be unlocked individually from the roof. So usually they would unlock me first and leave Risa behind, then one of them would walk me off a little ways to do what was needed. I was given very little time to do it, but I didn't need much time. It was understood that you got it out of you as quickly as possible. They wouldn't let you out again until the end of the day when they made camp. And if you fouled yourself before then, I imagine it brought a rather severe beating. When I was done, they would bring me back, lock me up, and then all five would unlock Risa and take him off for his turn. I worried about Risa knowing what to do the first time they took him. But when they came back, I saw three of the guards' faces were very pale, and so I understood the giant must have figured it out. We were fed once at the end of every day, a bowl of stew, clotted so thick with fat and grease that your shit fairly poured out of you like liquid the next morning, along with a heel of bread so maggot-ridden you were picking the little fuckers out prior to every bite. I wondered about that stew. I wondered if they were feeding us more of my donkey. There was no way to know for sure, and I had no intention of asking them. If you refused to eat, you were beaten. If you gagged on or spilled the stew, you were beaten. Always through the cage, you were beaten like an animal, with sticks usually. But the team master who drove us had an iron goad that he loved to employ quite sadistically. So it goes, and I told myself many stories to help choke that stew down. The nights were cool, but I was comfortable enough. Risa made a great deal of heat, and I'd always been small. The ability to sleep anywhere in any condition is a talent you learn on the cobbles, too. But Risa had it very badly. He had to be crammed back into the cage every time they put him in, and the roof was low enough that his head bowed over like a willow branch. I'd feel him shifting around at night, trying to find a position that didn't hurt, and sometimes he would pant for long stretches of time. I think he must have been in pain, or at least great discomfort, and the panting was him trying to keep quiet so I could sleep. One night, when I couldn't bear to listen to him anymore, I stood up in the cart to occupy as little of the floor as possible. The ceiling was high enough for me to stand, yet low enough that Risa could not comfortably sit. Then I prodded at him until he was able to lay over on his side, curled up like an old farm cat. He seemed to do better then. I was fucked, however. There was nowhere for me to be when Risa laid on his side like that, not unless I sat on him. So I ended up standing for as long as the giant slept. But I didn't mind. Standing through the night was better than listening to him try to be brave, and he always let me sleep through our travel on the next day. We continued on in this way for 2 days at least. It may have been more, but it is hard to remember now. Between 2 and 4, I guess. Eventually, we joined a much larger team, heading south, just as we were. This new group was very large, with cook fires and tents stretching all through a field. It was too hard to count, but I'd estimate at least 30 or so cook fires, all with something like 5 men sitting around them. Some of the men in this camp wore the king's colors. None of their banners bore the device of any lord, so these were king's men completely. Most of these appeared to be moving throughout the camp as they pleased, as if there were no immediate tasks for them to pursue. But there were a few who stood at attention with spears and always looked back and forth over the assemblage. I thought they looked away from the men at the fires as often as they looked directly at them, and I understood this to mean they kept watch against both intruders and deserters. So, despite all my efforts, it seemed we had finally joined up with Dittmar's recruiters. Our guards made a lot of noise riding into that camp. They hollered and whistled, and the passenger sitting up on the wagon's board waved a flag back and forth. They spoke with 2 uniformed men who stood watch at the camp's boundary. And after a scroll of parchment traded hands, there was a bunch of saluting, and the 5 men who had thus far been our jailers disappeared among the cook fires. And that was the last we saw of them. They must have returned to Goslar on the following morning. They left the rolling cage behind for our new captors. The morning routine with this new group was a larger, louder version of the routine we kept with Ambrosius's guards. A few men came around at first light, would take Risa and I individually to be relieved. It was better with this group, though, as they weren't just walking us over to trees and so forth. They dug pits into the ground every night, long pits that several men could straddle at once, and there was a large tent erected over these pits so that you could at least have some privacy from the rest of the camp. I was amazed the first time I saw soldiers digging those pits. I watched the other soldiers around them as they bent to their spades, but no one averted their eyes. They did not turn their noses up or jeer or shout insults, as I would have expected. Those who watched simply watched, and if any of the conscriptions commented, they were struck. Those whose duty it was to dig simply took the tools offered to them, and when they were done, those who dug sat down at the same fires with those who had observed, and no one said anything about what had happened. I noticed, too, that it was a different group of men who dug the pits every night. At the time, I didn't understand any of this, nor did I fathom what it meant. Later, when we went to Valhaz and lived as soldiers live, I understood. The soldiers hated digging those pits as much as any sane man would have hated the job. They hated it, but the job had to be done regardless, and the common truth about a soldier, the professional ones now, not the conscriptions, is that they all must carry out those tasks which are the most undesirable together. They must all slog through the same shit together, and one is no better or worse than the other, unless one is an officer, in which case every soldier knows that it is the officers who are useless because they will not slog through the same shit. It is the officer's role to point at the shit and tell the soldiers, "You there, you slog through that patch of shit." And if the soldiers wish not to be brutalized, they will slog. Once upon a time, I would have thought it was desirable to be the officer who points. But after living with and fighting beside the professionals, I know the truth of things. The worst kind of torture you could inflict on a soldier would be to send his colleagues off to slog through a patch of shit and hold him back. You hold the one soldier back so that he doesn't have to go with the others, and even if you tell him it is because he is favored, because he has done well and deserves this reward, he'll look at you with a seething hate, and he will look at his brothers, all of whom are waist-deep in the foulest shit imaginable and strain against the officer's will to join them. Soldiers live, it seems, differently to us. They are not us. They haven't a care for the estimation of people who are not soldiers. The regard of the plowman or the farrier means nothing. Soldiers concern themselves only with the regard of other soldiers, and the standards by which they set their behavior are alien and incomprehensible to outsiders. It sure seems to make sense to them, though, and goad and help he who falls out of line. After we were taken to be relieved, they would lock us back in the cage, where we would sit and watch as the camp was broken down. It happened very quickly, as though the striking of a camp was a thing these men had done many times. Even the men who were not in livery seemed to move with the same quickness as the recruiters, albeit with less surety and with what I judged to be less efficiency. Sometimes one of the soldiers would scream at the regular men or strike them, though I could not tell what for. They looked at the soldiers sullenly when this happened, but no challenge was offered. Then the tents were folded up and packed onto wagons. The coals from last night's fire were dashed, various chests and crates were filled, and the whole train was rolling again. This all took place within the space of an hour or so. They would drive us south, always south. I was unsure of the road we traveled, but it was paved more often than not, sometimes in flat rock, and wide enough for five horses to walk abreast of each other. There was a contingent of soldiers who rode out at the front of the column like a spearhead, followed by all of the common men who'd been collected. They all walked on foot, shambling forward without looking to see where they went. I saw that some of them hadn't any shoes, and that in some cases their feet bled through the rags that bound them. But they walked on without complaint. When the road was unpaved, the dust we kicked up was tremendous, until there was a brown haze everywhere, all around us, and many soaked rags in water to tie around their faces. Behind this procession was our cart, and behind us were the other wagons carrying all of the tents and food and other supplies. At the tail were more soldiers, and behind them, the wild dogs that followed invariably, always nosing for scraps. We traveled on in this fashion, many a long hour over many a long day, and the landscape seemed to change only grudgingly. A handful of soldiers on horseback would ride up and down the column of conscriptions as they shambled forward, oftentimes whistling loudly or shouting at the mass. Sometimes they would prod the men with their iron goads if they stepped too far away from the main body, or they might kick at them. or in some cases they would just ride up alongside the offender and shove him back into position with the horse's flank. The men accepted these corrections in all their forms docilely, and I was sick to my stomach to see it. So it goes, and I told myself many stories to help choke it all down. I was dreaming again. I've been having more of them, the dreams. When I was young, I had only nightmares. Then as a man on my own, I would still have the nightmares, though not as often. After a while, they went away. And also, I was drunk so much that if I ever had a dream, I didn't remember it. Being drunk is good for that. I lived a good long time not having dreams, and was very used to their absence. Now it seemed I was having them all the time. I was floating again, suspended in Erda, only I was close to the ground. I was floating right over it, as if lying face down in an invisible bed, looking at the grass beneath me. I thought about how soft it looked. But when I reached out to touch it, it vanished. I could feel the ground under my hand, but it did not feel like grass. It seemed smooth, like a sheet of silk, hard as stone, and was very cold. It made the bones in my hand ache, I think. It was so fucking cold. But it wasn't there, and I could see through the part that was gone. On the other side was everything else. Everything outside of Erda. And it was the darkest nothing I've ever seen.
Udo.
She wasn't there when I spun around. It was Erpicia again, or Ing, as I once thought of her. And when I say spun, of course I mean I turned in the air to look up into the high country. I saw the heart suspended high overhead, the strings stretching out along the same axis as my body, far away. The heart pulsed with yellow fire and hurt my eyes. Ing was not there. I turned back to the ground. Only I realized then that I was not floating over the ground, I was actually floating in front of the wall. I could still see the chaos. I could feel its hunger and wanted very much to close my eyes, but could not.
Udo.
Ing. My goddess Ing, where are you?
Udo,
she repeated. Something cold slithered around my neck and tightened. I heard ringing, and the darkness of the outer chaos spread out everywhere, like a cancer.
Udo, up and wakeful now, you blasted slug!
The iron collar yanked against my throat and I wanted to cough. I held it in, thankfully. The darkened shadow of a man stood below me. He was outside the cage, actually, on the ground, and the cage was up high enough that he seemed small, tugging on my chain and hissing my name over and over softly.
Gavin, is that you?
Yeah, it is. And what in hell's bleeding asshole sees you both shackled so?
Oh, let's not get into that now, all right?
What the fuck are you doing? Stop pulling that, damn it, that hurts.
He'd pulled the chain until my face was jammed into the bars.
Shut up, he whispered,
and then twisted on my collar until it was necessary to grind my teeth against the pain. He said,
think I could pick this?
Oh, you do?
I grunted.
Since when? God, you fuck! Since when have you been in the thieving business?
None of that. Most smiths can only make simple locks. Remember, I used to run a jail now.
You have to know how these work if you'll trust your life to them.
Feels like you're trying to twist my head off.
Keep bleating, and someone's sure to come around and twist her certain.
The collar clicked loudly, and I suddenly felt like I could breathe again. I sat there rubbing at the skin and marveling at how cool the night's air now felt as it passed through my throat.
Down here, Biggin,
Geffen whispered. He was speaking to Risa. I felt, rather than saw, the giant look at me through the shadows.
It's all right, Risa. That's Geffen. Don't you remember Geffen?
Fight?
That's right, Risa.
The cage creaked as if its axle was collapsing when Risa leaned over. I stood and moved to the corner by Risa's feet so he could have the most room and heard the sound of chain links clinking softly again.
Keep them open, Udo, Geffen warned.
I looked at the main body of the camp. They'd parked our cart over by the feed wagons, which were themselves located on the camp's edge close to the road. The feed wagons were very heavy, heavier than our cart, I'm sure, so they were kept close to the road to avoid their wheels becoming stuck in the loam. The closest tent to us was large, housing something like 10 men, but it was also several paces away, and the guards who patrolled the camp did not usually come out as far as the road. Beyond that tent were more tents, of course, and the entire camp was as dead as a graveyard. It was the captain's practice to post a watch every evening, so I knew they were out there. But I guess they were hidden by the tents. All of the cook fires that burned so merrily before were now full of cold ash and black char.
It seems clear for now, I said. It's great. Keep them open still.
I heard another clank, and then Risa was sitting up again. His top half was a huge, distorted blob that shifted around slowly, as if he were a sack filled with cats. I had to stare at him for a long time before understanding that he was rubbing at his neck, and all the misshapen writhing was just his arms hidden in shadow. I could hear him sucking in big gulps of air, and sympathized.
Excellent work, Gavin. What's next?
He was standing at the back of the cage, and though I could not see his expression, his posture said he was unsure.
Well, we unlock her now, don't we?
Right, I agreed. He didn't move.
Geffen. She's different.
Who's different?
The lock on this door. She's different.
Oh, well. Shit, you can't pick it?
His head darted around the lock like a hummingbird.
Think she's rusted?
This whole fucking box is rusted, I said uselessly.
Rusted, he muttered thoughtfully.
Then he perked up and said,
wait here.
As he rushed off, I hissed,
oh, are you sure? Shouldn't I just rather fuck off down the road then?
Asshole.
He came back a few minutes later. It was still so dark that I couldn't make out much more than a few large shapes, but I could see he was carrying something long.
Right. What's that now? I asked.
He whispered something, and I thought he said, who'd ask? So I said,
me, damn it, I'm asking. No, wood axe.
Whoa, you have a what?
Brought an axe. Stand away from the door.
Wait a fucking second.
Well then?
The plan is that you're going to smack the door with an axe?
What have you got, Udo?
Nothing really, Geffen, but bless your sweet, confused mind, I have to believe that nothing at all is better than smacking the cage with a goddamned axe.
You're right, Udo. Nothing's better. Stand away now.
Wait, will you? Will you fucking wait?
Oh, sheep's dogs and the fucking porridge, what'll you say now, boy?
Well, you're going to wake the camp, aren't you?
Oh, they'll awake eventually anyway, Udo.
It's slightly dip-
Keeper bottled, you daffy cunt, he winced.
It's slightly different, Geffen.
I want them not to wake while we're busy escaping, you lunatic. Can't you see why that would be a good idea? Have all the brains been knocked from your fucking melon?
He thought about that a moment and shrugged.
Might have, but there's no help for it, boy. If out's what you want, loud's what's needed.
Hell, we'll be very fast, Udo.
Oh, of course.
Nah, swear.
Look, this bastard's rusted through. She's ready to go, Udo. She's one good whack away from the three of us running down the road, can you fathom it? Can't you get some horses ready?
Nah, been hobbled. I'll have to unloose and bridle them. They'll wicker and put up a fuss, and then the camp will really hear us.
Well, they're gonna hear that fucking axe.
Sure, and it'll be the first thing they hear. We'll be through the brush before they're on their feet.
And what of the damned hounds?
He leaned against the axe.
Udo, you want out the fucking cage or not?
Yeah.
Well, and so stand away from the door now.
On three, eh? One. Two.
Either they had a third collar laying around somewhere, or one was custom made to fit Geffen's neck. I'm not sure. There wasn't enough room for him in the cage, and there was nothing else to put us in, so they fastened a longer chain to it and dragged him behind the cart on foot. He wouldn't speak to me that whole first day. I'd call out to him sometimes to see if he was over it, but he wasn't.
Well, Geffen, I sure am glad we were off like rabbits through the brush.
Well, Geffen, it's too bad that lock wasn't as rusted as you originally thought, hey? Look on the bright side, Geffen. That hound only got your pant leg. There could have been some serious lasting damage. and he wouldn't speak to me, the sour little idiot. He finally spoke to me on the second day, and then only to say, "Shut the fuck up about it already." It wasn't until the third that he consented to a true conversation.